Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Joe Gagne, along with my co-counsel, James Ardwan. We represent the appellant in this case, Mark Titus. Mr. Titus raised two issues on appeal, and I'll spend my time before the court on the first part of the first issue, and that is whether or not the government's breach of the plea agreement entitled Mr. Titus to withdraw his guilty plea.
What was the plea agreement?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What was the plea agreement was just a conversation between an investigator and a United States attorney. Sir.
Well, there was a plea agreement, Your Honor.
Online plea agreement. But then they amended it, as it were, with just a handshake and between an investigator and non-lawyer.
Correct. So aside from the plea agreement.
And the district court found that it didn't happen. It was clearly erroneous.
Correct. And that would go to whether or not the government made representations about their desire to seek forfeiture in this case, which led Mr. Titus to be induced into the plea agreement. But there's a separate issue, and that issue is whether or not the government's breach of the plea agreement by sending Mr. Titus a letter repudiating its obligations under the plea agreement allowed Mr. Titus to withdraw the plea agreement.
Now, how did it repudiate its obligations other than saying we're going to charge you with a new crime for your conduct after your plea agreement?
Correct. So its only obligation and its main obligation under the plea agreement was we're only going to charge you with this one offense and we're not going to bring
it. Let's assume he had pleaded guilty to stealing from his corporation and then he goes and steals some more from his corporation. You're saying they couldn't have charged him with that second crime?
No, because, well, that would be subsequent conduct. They said that they would only charge him with one charge for the circumstances arising out of the conduct that he had committed.
I understand, but I understood that this second or new charge resulted from additional conduct after his plea agreement.
No. The new charge resulted from that same conduct. They went through and made the decision that Mr. Titus had breached his plea agreement, and they unilaterally made that decision, so they decided that they were no longer bound by its terms. And that's what this issue at least boils down to, is whether they were entitled to make that decision.
When he pled, didn't he say that didn't he make an agreement there, make a representation there, that he understood everything and that no one had made any promises to him?
Yes, during the plea agreement, or during the plea hearing when he pled, he said that. But at that time, Your Honor.
Then after he entered the plea, then they filed the additional charges. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Not only did they file the additional charges, but before they filed the charges, they sent him a letter repudiating their obligations under the plea agreement. And that's the point when they
broke. But didn't he, he sort of baited the government by trying to hide his assets, right?
That's what they claimed.
Yeah.
But they never went through and had a judicial finding about that. They filed a motion to revoke his bond. And at that motion to revoke his bond, the district court said, why aren't you filing a motion to rescind your obligations under the plea agreement? And they said, well, we're reserving our right to do that, but we're not doing it right now. So instead of filing that motion to rescind so that they could have an evidentiary hearing on whether or not those allegations were true, they stood back and said, not yet. And then they didn't. They waited until after sentencing. And the problem with that is they made the decision unilaterally. They didn't seek a judicial finding on whether or not Mr. Titus had breached the plea agreement before they sent him that letter repudiating their obligations under the plea agreement. And that letter is when the breach occurred.
Did the government allege the grounds for the breach of the plea agreement when they wrote him the letter?
In abstract.
What did they say in abstract?
They said that he was in breach of his obligations to forfeit his assets and that conduct violated the terms of the plea agreement. And those were the grounds that they alleged.
I mean, but the plea agreement had no reference to forfeiting his assets, did it?
Yes, it did.
It did.
Okay.
It was the side agreement that said we're not going to forfeit. But even if that is the case, that still wouldn't give the government the authority to unilaterally make that decision.
But surely the plea agreement didn't say you've got to forfeit your assets and you've got to promise not to hide them.
The plea agreement required him to comply with the forfeiture.
Right.
I mean, there's no getting around that. But the problem is that the government never sought to enforce that forfeiture provision. I mean, for a period of a year, they knew about all of his financial assets.
What's the new charge? Obstruction of justice? What?
The new charge was a conspiracy charge based on these same allegations, which ultimately was dismissed in the district court. But that charge isn't the breach. The breach is when they sent him the letter.
I understand.
And the most important aspect of this case is that the government didn't have authority to repudiate its obligations because he was induced into pleading guilty based on the government's assertion.
Who was charged in the conspiracy with him, this new charge?
I don't believe anybody. I think it was...
Who were the unindicted co-conspirators in?
I don't know, Your Honor. I didn't represent him in that case. This case is not contingent on the result of that case.
What could your client possibly get out of voiding the plea agreement at this point?
What he would have been originally entitled to, and that is taking the case to trial.
Well, yes, but you didn't want to take the case to trial. I thought all this turned on the forfeiture. He's still trying to avoid a forfeiture.
Well, if he took the case to trial and contested it and was successful, the government wouldn't be able to tie the forfeiture to the judgment.
Well, but the man's already said that he stole money from quite a lot of money from the company through fraudulent invoices. So what else do you expect to get out of voiding the plea agreement?
Well, two responses to that. First is, it doesn't matter. In Santabello v. New York, the Supreme Court held that the defendant isn't required to show harm. And this court has upheld that in United States v. Valencia and United States v. Solling. So it doesn't matter whether or not he ultimately would be successful at trial. It doesn't matter whether or not he pled guilty and said, I am guilty. The key is, did the government breach the plea agreement? And if that's the case, then the defendant's entitled to withdraw his guilty plea.
What do you do with the judge's finding that that Titus breached the plea agreement in multiple ways?
The district court never made that finding in this case.
That's quoted.
No, respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. What the district court said was that there was some evidence that he had hid his assets. But what the government was required to prove is that by a preponderance of the evidence that Mr. Titus had breached the plea agreement. And the district court never made that finding. The district court's decision to deny the withdrawal of the guilty plea was based on a finding that Mr. Titus didn't prove up that there was this side agreement, or at least he wasn't satisfied with that proof. That was the district court's finding. The district court didn't make a finding about whether or not Mr. Titus had breached the plea agreement, and it also didn't make a finding about whether or not the government had breached the plea agreement. There was no finding in that, and there should have been. But the timing for that finding should have been at the time that the government decided that it was going to send this letter repudiating its obligations under the plea agreement. And this court has been consistent in that. In United States v. Solling, which was decided in 2000, the government had agreed not to make any argument regarding the sentence. And then at sentencing, it said that Mr. Solling had engaged in intervening criminal conduct after he had pled guilty. And so it alerted the court to that fact, and the court sentenced him based on that. And then this court held that the harmless error analysis did not apply when the government breached the plea agreement. And that decision stemmed from this court's decision in United States.
Explain to me again the exact breach that you're resting your case on.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Explain the exact breach. I mean, the terms of the breach, how this constitutes a breach of the agreement. I mean, make it very clear what your argument is.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case?
Yes.
So in this case, Mr. Titus and the government entered into a plea agreement. And in that plea agreement, Mr. Titus agreed to cooperate with the government, tell him everything that he knew. He agreed to wear a wire in his conversations with a co-defendant, and he agreed to plead guilty. The government, in exchange, agreed that they would not bring any additional criminal charges based on this conduct against Mr. Titus. And the government in, I believe it was August 9th, sent Mr. Titus a letter, which is in the record on page 237.
When did he plead guilty?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
When did he plead guilty?
Pled guilty in June 2011 was when the plea agreement was entered.
Okay.
And so in June, he enters the plea agreement. In August the following year, so a year later, they sent, after they had already accepted all the benefits of the plea agreement, had him wear a wire, had him give up all the information, a year later they sent him a letter.
More than a year.
More than a year. Year and a month or so, 13 months. They sent him a letter, and they said in the letter, we're no longer bound by the obligations under the plea agreement. We're rescinding our obligation. And their obligation was not to bring any additional criminal charges. And so under the — and these contracts, they're interpreted pursuant to the principles of contract law. Under the principle of anticipatory repudiation, which this Court has acknowledged in the Hentz case that the government cited, That right there constituted a breach at the time that the government made a clear statement that it no longer considered itself bound by its obligations. That's repudiating the contract, which is what they did.
And that vitiates his plea under that plea agreement.
Because there was no finding that they were justified in repudiating the contract, that was a breach. That vitiates his plea. At that time, he was entitled to withdraw his guilty plea. And that's what he did. He filed a motion to withdraw the guilty plea.
Would we remand the case for the district court to take a look at it? Has the district court addressed this issue that you're raising?
Not specifically, because when he filed the motion to withdraw...
You raised it before the district court.
We did, Your Honor. But
wasn't
the district,
that done at sentencing?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Was that done at sentencing?
The motion was filed before sentencing, but that hearing was carried with the sentencing hearing. So it conducted the hearing on the motion to withdraw right before the sentencing hearing, but on the same day. So at that time, the district court addressed this motion, but in its finding, it didn't make any findings regarding whether or not the government was justified in repudiating that the contract, which ultimately
he
is
just
a plea.
Found that there had been no repudiation?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did he find there had been no repudiation?
No, he didn't make any findings regarding it.
He did not address the motion?
Correct. Well, he addressed the motion, but he only addressed it with regard to whether or not there was the side agreement regarding the forfeiture. He didn't address the specific allegation, or he made no finding regarding the specific allegation.
Well, he denied the request to withdraw the plea, didn't he?
He did. He denied it, but he made no specific findings.
By implication, he found that the government could go forward with the plea, and your client couldn't withdraw his plea.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that's why we're here.
I understand that, counsel.
By implication, he certainly made that, but that was error by doing that, because it was clear on the face of the record that the government had repudiated its obligation. What's also clear is that the law of the Fifth Circuit and the law of the United States Supreme Court required the government to have a judicial determination of whether or not they were allowed to do that. In United States v. Castaneda, that's what this court held, that the government is not permitted to make that determination unilaterally.
Is this the, these cases run together, but is this the case where the U.S. attorneys were required to withdraw?
It is, Your Honor. This
What's
case
in
had
the
same.
Record about that?
It had the same U.S. attorneys as similar to the Denzinger shooting case, where that opinion was just issued. There was misconduct on the behalf of the U.S. attorney's office with posting comments online about some of the merits of their cases. That official misconduct was investigated, and they were required to withdraw. And that brings up an important factual point, and that is that year timeline where the government didn't complain about any of Mr. Titus's conduct or Mr. Titus's performance under the plea agreement, that's when those U.S. attorneys were on this case. It was when they were recused and the Department of Justice took over the prosecution of this case, that's when they claimed that Mr. Titus had breached the plea agreement, and that's when things went awry. Before that, the U.S. attorneys seemed perfectly satisfied with Mr. Titus's performance under the plea agreement.
What additional charges were, at what point in time did the additional charges arise, or the conduct underlying addition?
It was after sentencing, after Mr. Titus was, I believe it was about 2 weeks after he was
sentenced. No. What, were they indicting him for additional charges during the period of the original allegations of the indictment, or during
yes.
the period between guilty plea and sentencing?
The additional charges were for conduct that took place part and parcel with the original allegations. It was that same conduct. So it wasn't intervening subsequent conduct that they were indicting him for.
But didn't you argue this whole thing to the district court as the breach of a side agreement to withhold forfeiture?
In the motion to withdraw the guilty plea, there were two arguments made. One was that Mr. Titus was entitled to withdraw the guilty plea because it was induced by the government's side promise that it wouldn't seek forfeiture. And second is that he was entitled to withdraw the guilty plea because the government breached the plea agreement by repudiating their obligations under the contract. And so my time before the court today is spent with that second argument, which was the first argument that he raised on appeal. I think from the face of the record, it's also clear on the first issue regarding the side agreement. But I think that the more clear and the more obvious one is that the government
breached. The argument that you're making to us today fully before the district court in the motion?
Correct. This was raised fully in the motion to withdraw the guilty plea. And, okay. Your Honor, I do see that I'm almost out of time, so for these reasons, we do ask you to allow Mr. Titus to withdraw his guilty plea, and I look forward to speaking with you during rebuttal.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Gagnier. Mr. Smith, Department of Justice.
Good morning, Your Honors. And may it please the Court, Christopher Smith for the United States. Your Honors, the District Court was well within its discretion when it found that Mark Titus had presented no fair and just reason to withdraw his guilty plea. In denying Titus's...
What do you specifically say about the argument that he is making now? What is your version of that?
Your Honor, the thrust of the defendant's argument to withdraw his guilty plea was based on this secret side deal. At the time that Mr. Titus moved to withdraw the plea, the government, of course, had not filed any additional charges, although it had put Mr. Titus on notice that it considered him to be in breach and that additional charges would be filed. Therefore, in Mr. Titus's motion, he briefed the facts, I believe, that the government had put him on notice that it considered him to be in breach. And there was some suggestion that this, the government's position, folded into the Carr factors at the end of the motion, which is why the government did not argue waiver on this point. However, the motion was almost entirely focused on an allegation that the government had engaged in this side.
But did the government send a letter indicating that he had breached the agreement, and there was no finding that he had breached the agreement, and they indeed did file additional charges?
Yes, Your Honor, that's
all
correct.
That is true. Then why is his request for a remedy of withdrawing the plea agreement not satisfied here?
Well, Your Honor, at the time Mr. Titus breached his plea agreement and the government sent him that letter, he had already pled guilty in this case. It was not a question of contract law at that point. It was a question of Rule 11, because there are two issues in play, the plea agreement, which is governed by contract law, and the voluntarily entered guilty plea, which is governed by Rule 11. And in this case, Your Honor, the government sent the letter to...
They breached the plea agreement.
Your Honor, the government did not breach the
plea
agreement.
Why did they not breach the plea agreement?
Your Honor, the government's letter that was sent to Mr. Titus took the position that Mr. Titus was in breach of the plea agreement because the plea agreement made certain specific obligations of Mr. Titus. Among those obligations was to fully disclose and cooperate with the government in financial matters and figuring out where this money had gone in this million-dollar fraud. One of those obligations was to fill out a form called an OBD 500 form, which is the form that is a very detailed asset disclosure that's probative towards that purpose. Mr. Titus refused to fill out that form. Additionally, Mr. Titus violated his cooperation provision by beginning structuring his assets to shield them from forfeiture. Now, when Mr.
Was this after the plea had been accepted by the court?
Yes, Your Honor. The plea was accepted by the court, and Mr. Titus entered his guilty plea on October 26, 2011. And there was asset structuring that went on after that. The government moved forward and attempted to garner Mr. Titus's cooperation. And it wasn't until a year later, August of 2012, that it had become clear that cooperation was not forthcoming.
Well, I understood counsel for Mr. Titus to say it occurred before the plea agreement. You're saying that's not correct?
Your Honor, the cooperation that was not forthcoming was certainly after the plea.
Conduct upon which the charges were filed.
Your Honor, the conduct having to do, Mr. Titus was never charged with structuring in this case. That was simply a violation of his cooperation agreement with in the plea agreement. The ultimate charges that were filed were mail and wire fraud charges, which were the substantive counts that the government had agreed to forego in exchange for Mr. Titus's cooperation in this case. So this all deals with the same fraud of this company, Gardner Services Limited. It's all stemming out of one event. And the law in this circuit, in Heintz and other cases, is quite clear that when a defendant breaches the plea agreement, which Mr. Titus did in this case.
No, he says there's been no finding of that.
Well, Your Honor, I would back up with regard to the procedure that was followed in this case. that there has, there ultimately was a finding, although it was after the charges have been filed. The charges, the new charges, I should say, the additional substantive charges, were filed in a separate case before Judge Berrigan here in New Orleans after the hearing in this case. Judge Berrigan, a month later, held a hearing on Mr. Titus's motion to dismiss and found that Mr. Titus had breached the plea agreement, quote, in multiple ways. Now, we didn't brief that up extensively in this case because no charges had been filed at the time Mr. Titus moved to withdraw the plea in this case. So in that sense, it couldn't have been relevant to the district court's exercise of discretion. The procedure that the government followed in this case, once it became clear that Mr. Titus was in breach of his plea, the government, in its August 2012 letter, put Mr. Titus on notice that it considered him to be in breach and that additional charges would be filed. Mr. Titus had for 2 months an opportunity to notice any hearing he wished on this issue in order to protect his rights, and the hearing that he noticed and what he sought to do was to withdraw his guilty plea in this case. Now, in the hearing on withdrawing the guilty plea on this case, Judge Lamel, in this case, made two key findings that I would point the court to. He found it, quote, obvious from the record before him that the defendant was trying to conceal his assets in this case, and he also made an express finding on the record that Mr. Titus had lied to the court. Now, the plea agreement in this case contained an express term that said the defendant understands that he must be truthful, and if he is not truthful, this agreement is null and void. So at the hearing on this case to withdraw the guilty plea, the district court, while not expressly ruling on the government's arguments regarding Titus's breach, did make two factual findings that supported the government's
breach.
We would certainly argue that it constituted breach, Your Honor. So by the time the charges, the additional charges in the second case that's not before the court, were filed, there had been a finding on the record that Mr. Titus had lied to the court and that it was obvious from the record that he was structuring his assets.
And that was before you sent the letter?
No, Your Honor, that was after we sent the letter. That was after we put Mr. Titus, the letter simply put Mr. Titus on notice of the government's position that he was in breach, and it detailed the reasons why we believed he was in breach. Again, that giving, as this court suggested in United States v. Miller, which we briefly cited, putting the defendant on notice, giving him an opportunity to preserve his rights in whichever way he wished to do so. Mr. Titus filed after that letter. It was the first time Mr. Titus alleged that there was this secret forfeiture deal, which he then briefed up in his motion to withdraw the plea. That was the first time there had been an allegation of this secret deal, was after we sent that letter. The district court held a hearing. The district court in this case, Judge Lamel, held a hearing, analyzed each of the Carr factors, the factors that this court articulated in United States v. Carr, found that they tipped overwhelmingly towards not allowing Mr. Titus to withdraw his plea. In doing so, made a finding that Titus had lied to the court and that it was obvious from the record that he was structuring assets. And only then, after that hearing occurred, after Judge Lamel had made those findings, and after Mr. Titus was sentenced in this case, only then in the separate case did the government bring the new indictment charging Mr. Titus. Therefore,
there was a specific finding that there had been no breach with respect to these particular allegations that are being made here by Judge Berrigan.
Yes, Your Honor. After the additional charges were filed in front of Judge Berrigan in October 2012, and there was a hearing in December 2012, Mr. Titus in November, within a month, moved to dismiss that indictment based on his performance of the plea agreement and his view, and that was fully briefed up in that case, and Judge Berrigan denied the motion. So two district judges have looked at this
point. But the charges were dismissed.
The charges were ultimately dismissed on unrelated issues on the government's motion. The only thing in the record in that case is that it was the government's motion to dismiss the charges for evidentiary concerns and in the interest of justice. But it's important to remember that that case wasn't simply regarding Mr. Titus. It was Mr. Titus and his co-conspirator, Dominic Fazio, who was also charged in other schemes that were unrelated to the Garner Services fraud. Therefore, Your Honors, I would just emphasize that the defendants, all of the defendants' arguments at this point are predicated on his view that the government breached this agreement, which the government vehemently denies. The government performed its agreement until Mr. Titus stopped cooperating, started structuring his assets to shield them from forfeiture, refused to provide financial information. It was only at that point that the government, seeing that there was no avenue that his cooperation would continue, put Mr. Titus on notice of its position. Your Honors, I even though there hasn't been much discussion of it, I'd like to back up briefly to the other issue of the secret, alleged secret forfeiture deal, since that was the thrust of what Mr. Titus alleged in attempting to withdraw his plea. And I would just note that the district court found this allegation not credible, and Mr. Titus really has made no effort to show that that was clearly erroneous, nor can he, because there are three categories of evidence that make clear that no such deal existed here. First, the plea agreement in this case was very clear on this point. It stated that the defendant agreed to forfeit any proceeds, profits, or property received from the fraud of Garner Services. Beyond that, it included a merger clause, which stated that that written plea agreement represented the defendant's entire agreement with the government. There are not any other agreements, letters, or notations that will affect this agreement. Therefore, the plea agreement contained an express forfeiture clause and a merger clause, saying that there were no other agreements. Second, Mr. Titus was informed of this in court filings and in open court. Both the information that was filed in this case contained a forfeiture proceeding. Additionally, at his rearrangement in this case, the AUSA who was at the arraignment informed him of the maximum penalties, including forfeiture. And third, Mr. Titus's own actions are inconsistent with there being any agreement. He began structuring his assets in 2011 at a time when he claims he was relying on an agreement for there not to be forfeiture. Now, if he was relying on an agreement for there not to be forfeiture, there would have been no need for asset structuring. Additionally, Mr. Titus has noted that the U.S. Attorney's Office was voluntarily recused itself in this case and made much of that, but even when the U.S. Attorney's Office was prosecuting this case, in February 2012, they filed a motion for a preliminary judgment or a preliminary order of forfeiture, and Mr. Titus didn't object to that. So I think with the agreement clear on its face, him having been informed of it in open court, as well as his actions in this case, leave no doubt that the district court did not clearly err in that regard. And with regard to Mr. Titus's argument that the government anticipatorily repudiated the plea agreement in this letter, I would say that anticipatory repudiation occurs when one party repudiates an agreement and the other party is performing the agreement. The government's position was not an anticipatory repudiation. It was to the contrary. It was telling Mr. Titus that, in the government's view, he was not performing on the agreement, and that the government considered it to be released from its obligations. And at that point, Mr. Titus had already entered his guilty plea in this case, so it was a matter not just of contract law, but Rule 11. And as this court stated in United States v. Carr and other cases, the proper inquiry is for the district court to go through a series of seven factors and determine whether or not it is appropriate, in light of those factors, based on the totality of the circumstance, for the defendant to be able to withdraw. And here it wasn't. Those factors tipped overwhelmingly against allowing Mr. Titus to withdraw his plea. First, for over a year he had maintained he was guilty of this offense. He confessed to it and the factual basis to his plea. He maintained his guilt and has never denied looting this company of over almost $1 million. Secondly, Mr. Titus had competent counsel, the same counsel that represents him today, throughout his plea negotiations. And third, he pleaded guilty following a lengthy and accurate Rule 11 colloquy with the district court in this case in front of Judge Lamel. And that's one of the reasons why Judge Lamel ultimately found that there was no fair and just reason for Mr. Titus to withdraw this plea. And Mr. Titus is arguing now regarding the timing of a determination of the breach of this plea agreement or other issues that really are appropriate more for an appeal of a conviction stemming out of additional charges that were filed. It's important to remember that Mr. Titus is the only issue before the court here is whether the district court abused its discretion in finding that there was no fair and just reason to withdraw the plea in this case, and the government contends that there was not, and asks this court to affirm both the conviction and the sentence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Gagne?
Please the court. I'd like to address 2 points that Mr. Smith raised in his argument. First, regarding the factual finding that he claimed that Judge Lamel made. It was not the case that the district court found that there was substantial evidence, or that it was obvious from the record that Mr. Titus had structured assets. Judge Lamel said that it was obvious that there was evidence in the record. And that's a big difference because the burden that they were required to meet was a preponderance of the evidence. So there was no specific finding. Secondly, he claimed that there was specific finding that Mr. Titus was in breach of the plea agreement because it claimed that that the district court had found that Mr. Titus had lied. That statement was regarding Mr. Titus's statement initially when he made the plea that there were no other agreements, so that he was not induced. So the district court did not make any finding that Mr. Titus had lied to the government and was therefore in breach of the plea agreement. So to the extent that the government represented that, it's just not true. Second was the government's claim that they didn't breach the plea agreement. And it's just not true. By any standard of how this court interprets the word breach, the government was in breach of the plea agreement when it repudiated its obligations under the agreement. And there's a good case by this court in Valencia, where this court said that definition of a breach is...
Well, let me ask you, what remedy did the government have if it thought, had good reason to believe that he was structuring transactions?
It was required to file a motion to rescind its obligations under the plea agreement.
Why? Why couldn't they just, I don't understand, and you're saying that they warned him and he went to court to withdraw the guilty plea and the court said no dice. So why doesn't that accomplish the objective?
Because the government doesn't have the authority to make the decision that he had breached the guilty plea on its own. They're required to have the district court make that
finding.
Well,
the court held a full hearing on this and it said there's no fair and just reason to deny to withdraw the plea.
It did that after the government had already repudiated its obligations under the plea agreement.
That precipitated your motion to withdraw, did it not?
It did, Your Honor.
Well, so what I'm saying is you end up at the same place that you were before, except that the court is saying, on balance, there, with all the facts before me, there is no fair and just reason to repudiate to void the plea agreement.
And the United States Supreme Court in Santabella said that didn't matter.
But wait. All the government did in that letter was say, you have breached, we feel that we can go ahead and file additional charges. Then you go to the court and you say, they're not telling you the truth because they broke their deal to, you sort of raise this smoke about the side agreement, there's not going to be a forfeiture. And then the court hears everybody's side of it, and the court says there's not a good reason to withdraw the plea here.
And that's no different than what happened in Santabella. In Santabella, the defendant had determined that there was a basis to file a motion to suppress the evidence that he didn't know about. So he filed a motion to suppress the evidence, and then the government turned around and argued that for a heightened sentence, when they had made a plea agreement not to argue during sentencing, they turned around and argued during sentencing Mr. Santabella should be punished. And the district court said, that didn't affect me at all. I sentenced him to what I sentenced him to because of...
Go ahead.
The district court sentenced and claimed, put it on the record, that that the government statements didn't affect him whatsoever. And the Supreme Court held that it didn't matter that he got what he otherwise would have had. That didn't matter. The question was, did the government fulfill its obligations under the plea agreement? And if that answer is no, then the government can't then claim that, well, this was harmless, this really didn't matter, because the district court later found that it ultimately didn't matter.
Yeah, but that undermined your argument that the breach occurred at the time that the letter was sent.
Correct.
Well, no, because it says if the government does not carry out the terms of the agreement, there's a breach. That's what you said, Santa Bella said.
No, well...
And so the breach actually occurs when he institutes the new charges. Now, here, for example, what if the government had sent the letter and nothing ever happened? Would they have breached the plea agreement?
Yes.
Just by sending that letter?
Yeah, well, anticipatory repudiation is once you make a statement that makes clear on its face.
But what if they carried out all of the terms, ultimately carried out all the terms of the plea agreement, even though they claimed that he had breached it?
They had still breached at the time they sent that letter. The defendant,
that seems like a hyper-technicality.
The defendant's entitled to rely on the statements made by the government. And if the government makes a statement that it's not going to comply with its obligations under the plea agreement, that would be no different than if I had signed a contract with the government to show up and present this oral argument today for the government a letter.
What if the shoe had been on the other foot and the defendant says in the course of before it's sentenced, I am breaching this agreement. I think the government has not fulfilled its agreement. So the agreement is breached, and then the defendant can withdraw his plea on the basis of his own determination that the agreement has been breached?
Well, if you agree with what the government says, then yes. But that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the defendant would be entitled to file a motion to rescind his obligations under the plea agreement. Under the government's logic, that's not the case.
All you're saying here, the government declared it was breached.
Correct.
Therefore, it was breached. If the defendant had declared it was breached, would the contract also be breached? And if not, why not?
If the defendant claimed that the contract had been breached by the government and wanted to rescind its obligation.
No. It's breached. So you're saying that it was breached by the sending of the letter.
Correct.
Let me
answer that more specifically. If the defendant sent the government a letter and said, I believe that you've breached, I'm not going to fulfill my obligations, then the defendant would be in breach of the plea agreement. And the government wouldn't have to abide by the terms of the plea agreement if there was a finding by the district court. And, Your Honor, that specific case actually happened.
No. You're saying that he could withdraw it.
No, Your Honor. The government would be entitled to withdraw.
The defendant could withdraw the plea agreement because you claim the government breached it.
No. The government would be entitled to withdraw at that point. So if the government...
But if they didn't want to, the government comes back and says, we have not breached, you're not going to withdraw from this.
That's why this court in Valencia and Salling gave that option to the affected party, that they didn't have to withdraw. They could also enforce specific performance. But they left that option to the affected party.
Isn't that what you were trying to do with your withdrawal motion?
Correct. Yes.
You were trying to enforce the plea agreement.
No. We were trying to...
Yes, you were, because you wanted to have your cake and eat it too and not have a forfeiture.
No, Your Honor. When we filed the motion to withdraw, we were asking to withdraw the guilty plea. If we wanted the guilty plea enforced...
In part because there was a side agreement not to forfeit.
That's correct. I mean, that was part of the reason why they filed the motion to withdraw. But it wasn't specific performance. That's not what we asked the court for.
The bottom line would have been that because there was a side agreement that your client did not have to comply with the forfeiture obligation.
Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. May I respond to your question?
Yes, sure.
Your time ended about 5 minutes ago, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. It's not the case that if he withdrew the guilty plea that he would be wiped clean of this and he wouldn't have any forfeiture provision. The government would still be entitled to get a judgment against him. All that would happen is he wouldn't have waived his rights to a jury trial. And that waiver of the rights...
No, he would have also gone back to square one on forfeiture, and the government would have been able to bring all those additional charges.
That's correct.
Structuring has a lot bigger potential sentence than mail fraud.
That's correct, Your Honor, but that would have been his option, and that's all he's asking to do, okay, is go back to where he was.
Okay, Mr. Gagne, thank you very much.
Thank you
for
Your
Honor.
Argument.
Thank the government for its argument. Both of you have presented your arguments well.